welcome to Vital Voices for part two of our interview with John U. Bacon about his best-selling book, The Gales of November, the untold story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The Edmund Fitzgerald sank in the waters of Lake Superior on November 10, 1975. We ended last week's program by talking about the ship's captain, Ernest McSorley. John Bacon points out that McSorley was a highly competent and deeply respected captain.
He was so considerate and soft-spoken with his crew that they followed him from ship to ship to ship, and including his final appointment on the best ship in the Great Lakes, Edmund Fitzgerald.
So we've got a competent captain. It seems that experts, including yourself, have not settled on a single reason for the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Instead, you point to a combination of things. Give us a summary of what seems to have gone wrong.
Sure. Well, I got about 20 books behind me, Fred, of other books that have been written before. I got to work. Most of them are in the whodunit category of what happened, here's their theory, and so on. A lot of guys got theories. But I go with John Tanner, an expert on this, who had two of his cadets on this ship. He was the former superintendent of the Great Lakes Maritime Academy in Traverse City, Michigan, in northern lower Michigan. And he said, when a big ship like this goes down, it is very rarely one cause. It's a series of dominoes that start falling, and when they start falling, it can happen fast, and watch out. In this case, what do you have? You have a ship that was built with the new technology at the time, but that included favoring welds over rivets, and I bet a lot of folks down there would know that welds are cheaper, they're faster, they're lighter. They're 1.2 million pounds lighter on this ship than using rivets, which means you can carry 1.2 million more pounds of iron on each run. They make 50 runs a year. That adds up very fast. That's 60 million pounds a year by going with welds instead of rivets, but they're not as strong as rivets. So this ship flexes more than most ships. That can be good for the most part, like a skyscraper in the high winds. But in 69, 71, and 73, the U.S. Coast Guard changed the edicts, the rules, the regulations, for how low in the water this ship was allowed to sink. So it used to have 14 feet of its 39 feet above the water. They reduced that to about 11 feet. They gave it 3 more feet, or 4,000 more tons, a clearance, if you will, for more iron. This ship wasn't built for that. So now it's too flexible. And now you're overloading it on every single run. There's two problems. Three, you have this storm of the century. Man, the winds got up to 100 mile per hour winds, and the waves got up to 60 foot waves. You guys know hurricanes. It's basically a hurricane on the Great Lakes. So, and on top of that, whatever could have gone wrong went wrong. The long radar got knocked out by the storm. The short radar got knocked out by the storm. The lighthouse you're trying to get to at Whitefish Point is just 17 miles away. That light gets knocked out by the storm. So does the radio beacon, which tells you where you are. Now you are sailing blind in a storm. The storm has showed up. It's dark. It's got snow going sideways. You are in trouble.
I'm sure you've imagined in your mind the last few hours of the lives of those 29 men. When you tried to recreate in your mind how they died, what mental images keep recurring?
I've never gotten that question before, Fred, and I've done a lot of interviews, so I appreciate that. I'll tell you who has thought about it more than I have, of course, are the family and friends of men on that ship, and I've talked to 14 of the 29 families, and they all had nightmares about this for years afterwards, and most of the nightmares involved envisioning their loved ones, their fathers, their uncles, their cousins, their boyfriends, on this ship in those final moments. So it's a topic I had to think about more than I would have liked. If there's a silver lining, I'll say this. There's a lot of debate as to what happened and when. Did the ship bottom out before it sank? Did it create damage to the bottom of the hull, etc.? Well, we all agree on one thing. When the end happened, it had to happen very quickly. Why? Because McSorley, experienced captain that he was, never got an SOS out. If he had even 10 seconds, he would have done that. The lifeboats were secured. They were not released. Life jackets were still in the closets. So they did not think they're going to go down at that moment. So whatever happened would have happened very quickly, probably in the matter of, I mean, as one of the guys said, his uncle was on the ship. However long it takes you to drown is how fast these guys died in a few minutes. So it was not a long, anxious process. But what I think about is this. The lights have to go out. The power goes out. You're going down hard and fast, 35 miles an hour now, to the bottom. It hits the bottom. It's 530 feet deep where it hit. But this ship is 729 feet long. So when it hits, you still have 200 feet, outside the water. Mm-hmm. That's how big it is. But it probably cracked after it hit. But for these guys, the power's out. This freezing cold water, 40 degrees, is coming in a rush. And you very quickly have no air to work with. So it had to be terrorizing. It had to be fast. You had to know right away that this is it. There was not any debate. And again, these guys have had dreams about this for a long time. But as Tom Walton, whose uncle was on the ship, and he had served in the ship, and his dad had served in the ship beforehand, he said, I had that dream for years. One silver lining is it only could have lasted 2 or 3 minutes.
You mentioned survivors. Tell us about some of the survivors, the family members of the crew you got to know as you were doing research for the book. Whose stories from that group touched you most deeply?
Well, they all got to me on some level, certainly. And trust me, despite being a jaded journalist, I pulled more than a few tears talking to these people. But I can say that Bruce Hudson, I mentioned him earlier, he's the only child of Ruth Hudson. Ruth Hudson must have been a firecracker. She was 4'9", and as her niece, Pam Wittig, whom I came very close to, Aunt Ruth was 4'9", but she told you she's 5'5", and you believed her. So she was something, not highly educated, but a great reader. So very well-spoken, very well-dressed, worked at the Bonnie Bell Cosmetic Factory in Cleveland. Their only son, he was an Eagle Scout, also a member of the band, a lot of school pride at North Olmsted, right outside of Cleveland. But also had a bit of a hellion streak. He always had a motorcycle and a girlfriend. And he drops out of Ohio State, where he's studying forestry, to hop on one of these ships for a couple summers. And why do you do that? Because back then, man, a deckhand, the lowest guy on the ship out of 29, he's making 3 or 4 times what a teacher made even back then. Hmm. In current dollars, it'd be the equivalent of about $180,000 for 9 months worth of work. And who wouldn't take that opportunity? Hmm. And it's a fun lifestyle in many ways. It's hard. But it's fun if you're single, especially, and you're off the ship every 3 days in the local bars and whatnot. And he's got one weakness. He's very good at saving his money. He's got one weakness, and it's his 1972 Dodge Challenger muscle car. And, Fred, we found the car. It's still in Toledo. It's in pristine shape. It's still immaculate. And it still has a sticker with a smokestack of the Emma Fitzgerald in the back passenger seat, which he put on in 73 or 4. That's how proud he was to serve in the Fitz. So he and his fellow deckhand, Mark Thomas, also from Cleveland, they're going to hop in that car in 3 days, just 3 days away from Toledo. The car is waiting for them in the dock. You hop in that car, and you go out west to Colorado to get Coors beer, because back then, Fred, that was exotic, I swear to God.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
that's what they're doing. And then they're going to go to L.A. and come back along Route 66, and they had it all planned up. And then in September, 2 months before the ship went down, Bruce's girlfriend, a waitress, Cindy Reynolds, in Toledo, calls him up at one of the sailor bars in Silver Bay, Minnesota, and says, guess what? I'm pregnant. So he's got to think fast. And he says, you know what? Don't worry about this. We're going to move in together. We're going to raise the child ourselves. I'm making good money. I can still go back to school. We'll be okay. And she's relieved by this. And she says, you know what? Go on that trip anyway. It'll be in November. It's only a month. You'll be back long before the baby comes in June. Okay. And, of course, the ship goes down. Ruth Hudson thinks that she's lost her only child, and she has. I can't imagine that heartache. But then 6 months later, she finds out from Cindy Reynolds that, guess what? You're about to be a grandmother. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, she was.
Yeah.
Heather is born in June of 1976. She has 4 children. The oldest looks just like Bruce Hudson. And Ruth Hudson told her niece, Pam, I love all my 4 grandkids the same, but yes, I play favorites, and Austin is it.
And these families continued to get together to make sure that the lives of the people they lost are not forgotten.
Exactly right, Fred. The tragedy speaks for itself. The heartbreak, nothing can repair that, obviously. But some silver linings have come out of this, including, of course, Austin, the grandson of Bruce Hudson. But also these families, the crew was very close, by all accounts, and as one of the former crew members, Patrick Devine, who had been on the ship just 2 months earlier, he said that crew was absolutely elite. Every guy in his field was the best on the Great Lakes as deckhands or oilers or engineers or whatever they were doing. He said, and there were no weirdos. He said, and this was the 70s. So, you know, the 70s, you know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
But so the crew was close, but the families did not know each other at all. About one third live in Duluth, which is on the western corner of Lake Superior, Duluth, Minnesota. One third in Toledo, Ohio. One third in Cleveland, Ohio. They didn't know the names. They had no addresses, no phone numbers, no cell phones back then, no computers, of course. But with all the anniversaries and the effort to get the bell brought up from the bottom of Lake Superior and get the site declared an international grave site by the Canadian government, it is just barely in Canadian waters. They became incredibly close. And as Heidi Wilhelm told me, she's at the time 12-year-old daughter of Blaine Wilhelm, one of the oilers in the ship. She said at one of the reunions when I'm with these people, said, these people are not like family. These people are family. Mm-hmm. And she grabs two of the arms of her sisters, as she calls them. She said, who else could possibly know how it feels to go through this? Only they can. And at that point, she asked her daughter, Sarah, who was born on the 21st anniversary of the sinking on November 10th in 1998, that took her grandfather, a grandfather she would never meet, of course. When she's 21, she gets a tattoo. The last words Ernest McSorley ever delivered, when his fellow captain on the Anderson says, how are you making out with your problems? He said, we are holding our own. And that became a rallying cry for these families. And then Heidi asked Sarah, her daughter, show John the tattoo on your arm. Sarah pulls up the tattoo she got when she's 21 years old on the same anniversary. And it says on her arm, we are holding our own. Mm-hmm. These people truly are.
Wow. Gosh, great story. If we visit, you mentioned the bell, if we visit Lake Superior today, what tributes to the 29-member crew can we see?
There are a lot of great museums on the Great Lakes, and I got to discover most of them in the process of writing this book. There's one in Toledo that's fantastic, one in Detroit, one at Whitefish Point you're talking about, another in Marquette, another in Duluth on Lake Superior. South Haven, Michigan's got a great one. But I think the best one, of course, I'm biased, is the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point. This is the point that the ship was trying to get to. It's the closest point on land you can stand on and look out and know that the ship is 17 miles out that direction. That's the lighthouse they're trying to get to. That's the bay, that home plate. That's going to be safety. This is where, when they brought the bell up, they tried to decide where to put it. At Mariner's Church in Detroit, which, of course, Gordon Lightfoot mentions, they decided ultimately to put it in the museum. You can see it there. It's covered in plexiglass, but once a year they bring it out to ring it for the 29 men and 30 times for the souls lost on the Great Lakes altogether. And this year, in the last 2 years, 31 times once more for Gordon Lightfoot. So they've got the bell. That's where the families come for their anniversaries. That's where I see them every year. On the 50th anniversary, the governor of the state of Michigan, she drove up for that. 3,000 people came out in bitter cold, 25 degrees. 3,000 people came out with no tickets, no place to stay. 3,000 people came out as a two-mile backup of cars on both sides. That's 4 miles of cars. So just an incredible outpouring of love and respect for these families. It's really quite cool.
Let's go back to music for a second. There are lyrics from Gordon Lightfoot's ballad, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, printed in the back of your book. But there are also the lyrics from another 1970s hit. Explain the importance of the song Brandy in the lives of Great Lakes sailors in general.
Good reading there again, Fred. Yes, we had to buy the rights for the Edmund Fitzgerald. Not a question there, of course. It's the title of the book. The Gales of November comes from the song. We got to quote it a lot throughout, of course. We had the lyrics in the back. The tougher call was Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. And the reason I put that in there is because that, if you know that song, mm-hmm. It's the anthem for these guys. It came out in 1972 as the number one hit in the country. It's a one-hit wonder. A wonderful, beautiful song. And for these guys, that was their anthem. Trust me, I've been to all these Great Lakes bars, the sailor bars, and that song is still played to this day in all the jukeboxes around the Great Lakes. It describes what? It describes their lives perfectly. He's got a girlfriend who's a waitress in a sailor bar, and she wants him to, you know, settle down. He says, my life, my love, and my lady is the sea.
What did the shipping industry learn from this tragedy that has, so far at least, prevented anything like it from ever happening again?
Well, you're right. And to back up your last point, as I said earlier, 6,000 shipwrecks on the Great Lakes, not, you know, sailboats and rowboats, commercial shipwrecks. from 1875 to 1975, just a terrible total, 30,000 men lost, and some people say it's a lot more than that. But guess what? Since November 10th, 1975, there have been exactly zero shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. Not one man lost to a shipwreck. That's an incredible, I don't know what stat is crazier, Fred, 6,000 for 100 years or zero for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is the Edmund Fitzgerald. We've had no terrorist attack since 9/11. After Titanic, you've got enough lifeboats on all the ships, of course. So this was the shipwreck that woke up the entire industry, which had been complacent. As one of my experts said, when do you fix anything? When it's broken. So this was such a big breaking, the greatest ship in the Great Lakes going down, that they got much better about forecasting, about communicating those forecasts to those captains. They could have done both those things better that day, frankly. And more, perhaps more importantly, common sense. The day after the 49th anniversary, November 11th, 2024, 30, 40-mile-per-hour winds, those 10, 15-foot waves, pretty serious stuff. And every single ship was docked, was at anchor in Whitefish Bay. And I guarantee you, Fred, 50 years earlier, not one of them would have been, including, of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald. So common sense has finally kicked in.
And my final question, how have survivors' families reacted to the publication of your book?
I've got good news there. Now, you're better off talking to them than me, because I'm clearly biased here myself. But I was very concerned about their reaction, absolutely. It's uniformly positive. They feel great that the story's been told in full. They had never talked to a journalist before, not one of them. And they are uniformly positive about it, how they're depicted. And we didn't try to sugarcoat it. I mean, these guys like to drink, and the guy got his girlfriend pregnant and so on. It's all true stories. But the respect for the field also, what they themselves did not know, is exactly what their dads did for a living. They didn't know how important it was. There was a 16-year-old girl in Milwaukee, Deb Champeau, a 12-year-old girl in Mauqua, Wisconsin. They really didn't know what their dads did or how important it was. They're grateful that not only they found out, but now the world is finding out as well. So I appreciate that.
Our guest has been John U. Bacon, author of the best-selling book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. If you missed part one of our interview, you can find it at WETS.org, then programming, then podcasts for Vital Voices. I'm Fred Sossman.